Before you go any further with this episode, I want you to download the free app Vodacast and listen to this episode there. Vodacast is a podcast player, but what sets it apart from regular podcast players is that they provide deeper digital stories. For example, you could be listening to this episode on Vodacast and immerse yourself in some bonus content, such as photographs related to the case, including photographs of the victim and photographs of the criminal investigation, as well as links to newspaper articles and much more. As you listen on Vodacast, the bonus content appears at the appropriate time in the episode, so you could be listening about certain evidence and see it on your screen for yourself. I'm going to be mentioning certain things that you can see on Vodacast throughout this episode, so download the app now to make sure that you don't miss out. Just click the link in my show notes or search for Vodacast on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. It was early March of 2006 when a 12-year-old boy came forward to police in Winnipeg, Canada, to reveal a disturbing secret. He informed police that his 5-year-old stepsister had been systematically abused and then murdered the year beforehand, and then secretly buried. An investigation into his claims would reveal many systemic failures in the very system which is entrusted to protect children. The little boy informed investigators that his stepsister, 5-year-old Phoenix Sinclair, had been locked in a cage, repeatedly shot with a BB gun, and deprived of food and water in the weeks leading up to her murder, which happened on the Fisher River Cree Nation, around 220 kilometres north of Winnipeg, in June of 2005. Phoenix was then allegedly wrapped in a plastic sheet and buried near a garbage dump. His grim revelation led to his father, who was Phoenix's stepfather, 43-year-old Carl Wesley McKay, being arrested and charged with second-degree murder, as well as Phoenix's mother, 24-year-old Samantha Keymatch, being arrested and charged with forcible confinement, failure to provide the necessities of life, aggravated assault with a BB gun, and assault with a broomstick. Following the boy's confession, investigators quickly got working on the case. Somehow, Phoenix's disappearance had remained a secret for almost 1 year. She had never been reported missing by anybody, and now a little boy was claiming that she had been murdered and buried by those who were entrusted to care for her. Initially, investigators were working on the theory that Phoenix was still alive and potentially in the care of Child and Family Services. When Samantha was interrogated after the boy came forward, she claimed to investigators that Phoenix was still alive and even presented another young girl who she claimed was Phoenix. Investigators went to the couple's home, and in the basement they discovered a pig pen, which they speculated was where Phoenix had been kept. As it would be discovered, Phoenix had been in and out of child welfare agencies since her birth. She was born on the 23rd of April 2000. Samantha was a young mother who was being abused and neglected by her own mother and was herself a ward of Child and Family Services until just a few months before she gave birth to Phoenix. She had been involved with gang members, had run away from foster homes and had stolen cars in the past, as well as struggled with addiction and had a history of anger and aggression. In fact, Phoenix wasn't her first child. She had another daughter who had been seized by Child and Family Services. Following the birth of Phoenix, she immediately became a ward of Child and Family Services, also known as CFS. When CFS came to take Phoenix, it was noted that Samantha didn't seem bothered whatsoever. Phoenix's father, Steve Sinclair, helped to get Phoenix ready to be taken away. Less than a week later, however, Samantha and Steve decided that they wanted Phoenix back. They met with CFS intake worker Andrew Oropko, who drafted up a plan to get Phoenix back. However, social workers questioned the real motivation behind them wanting Phoenix back, particularly in regards to Samantha. They noted that when she spoke with her, she seemed disinterested and had even been referred to as aggressive by several CFS case workers. They ordered Samantha to undergo psychological assessment, attend parenting classes, and meet weekly with Phoenix. The purpose was to see if Samantha could develop parenting skills and address any psychological issues that she was suffering. 6 months later, Phoenix was returned to their care. She was returned more than a week before Samantha underwent psychological examination. CFS workers had believed that Samantha had improved, and her file was then transferred to another Winnipeg CFS caseworker in October of 2000. The psychological examination of Samantha consisted of a one-off casual session by Dr. Gary Altman, who wasn't informed of Samantha's troubled past. All he was asked to do was determine if Samantha was suffering from depression, and he concluded that she was not. By the time Phoenix was 15 months old, Samantha had essentially vanished from her life. Her infant sister had died suddenly, and Phoenix was being moved from pillar to post by her father, Steve, who himself was suffering with deep issues. Despite this, Manitoba CFS decided to close her child protection file, after reaching the conclusion that there was no evidence to support further CFS intervention. This decision was made even though a caseworker had never checked in on Phoenix or checked out any of the adults in her life. In February of 2003, Phoenix was taken to hospital by a man claiming to be her godfather. She had an infection from an object that had been lodged in her nose for around 3 months. The hospital reported the matter as a probable case of neglect. A social worker went to Phoenix's home and was met by Steve, who said that Phoenix was being cared for by a family friend. The same social worker went back to the house several times over the course of the next 4 months, but each time nobody answered the door. A couple of months later, Phoenix was placed back in the care of CFS, but shortly thereafter, Phoenix was back with Samantha, and this time, Samantha had a new boyfriend named Carl. By January of 2004, CFS were tasked with looking into a complaint about Samantha drinking and smoking crack in front of Phoenix. Several months later, CFS was once again looking into Phoenix after a caller reported that Samantha was seeking government child welfare benefits for Phoenix, but Phoenix wasn't in her care. Samantha was contacted, and CFS reportedly knew that Phoenix was being looked after by friends Kim Edwards and her husband Rohan. When questioned as to why she was leaving Phoenix with friends for such prolonged periods, Samantha uttered a profanity and then hung up the phone. As news of the arrests were made public, Kim Edwards came forward. Kim had provided on and off care for Phoenix since she was an infant and said that in her short 5 years on Earth, she had been removed from her mother's care, but said that she was always returned to her custody. She said that while Phoenix was in her mother's care, she still continued to visit her when Samantha didn't want to look after her, until one day, Samantha showed up and asked to take Phoenix, and that was the last time that she ever saw her. Speaking with the Edmonton Journal, Kim said, "She was a wonderful, loving, and smiley kid. I'm devastated. She just wanted to be loved." According to Kim, she had always feared that Phoenix was being mistreated at home, and she tried in vain to get the police and child welfare authorities to intervene. Because she wasn't Phoenix's legal guardian, there was nothing that she could do. With no body being found and the talk of a child slipping through the cracks, it was announced that all of the resources of Manitoba's justice system would be brought in to investigate. Manitoba Premier Gary Doer stated, "The court made a decision to take this child into custody. The social worker, we believe, made a decision to return the child to their mother. That's what I understand, but we'll have to get more information." On the 15th of March, Carl and Samantha were charged with first-degree murder. The couple had two children together, a girl who was almost 2 years old, and a boy who was born just a couple of months before their arrest. They moved to the Fisher River Cree Nation in spring of 2005, and shortly before their arrests, they had moved back to Winnipeg. As investigators were still trying to find Phoenix's body, people were left wondering who Phoenix was. According to some neighbours of Carl and Samantha, they had never even seen them with children. But life for Phoenix wasn't always like this. At one point in her short life, she was loved and cared for, just not by Carl and Samantha. Kim, who was Phoenix's foster mother at one point, described Phoenix as a curious and funny little girl who absolutely loved everything, from puppies to electric guitars. She said that she was a massive animal lover. Kim stated, "If I had to describe her in one word, I'd say beautiful. She was curious, she was funny, she was a real funny kid." She said that when Phoenix stayed with her, she was always treated like part of the family. Her favourite cartoon was Blue's Clues, and she loved Metallica. Phoenix's disappearance and alleged murder raised questions about the child welfare system in Manitoba. The child welfare system in Manitoba was extremely troubled, and Phoenix suggested that a bureaucratic mistake could have been partly to blame. Back in 2005, files on Aboriginal children at the Family Services Division in Winnipeg were transferred to new agencies which were Aboriginal run. According to politician Mavis Tallou, there was a chance that some files may have been closed for the transfer on the assumption that the new agency would reopen them. She stated, "What we've heard with the whole transfer process was that it was pushed through very quickly, that there was a lot of room for error." Following this, a spokesperson for Family Services Minister Christine Melnick said that the information on Phoenix had not been transferred to an Aboriginal agency because her file had been closed around 2 or 3 months before the transfer had occurred. Before Phoenix's murder, Samantha had filed documents which indicated that she wanted her daughter's case to be transferred from Winnipeg CFS to Southern Authority, which was the Aboriginal-run agency. However, it soon became apparent that the case was never transferred to Southern Authority. Instead, Winnipeg CFS just decided to close down Phoenix's case. In March of 2005, CFS had been called out to see Phoenix at Samantha's house to investigate allegations that she was being abused and locked in her bedroom. Samantha rebuffed the abuse allegations and the CFS workers left without actually seeing Phoenix. They returned to the office and simply closed Phoenix's file. For a system whose sole job it is to care for children, this was extremely alarming. Premier Gary Doer announced that he was thinking about calling an inquiry into Phoenix's death, while politician Mavis Tallou expressed her fear that there could be other children just like Phoenix in danger. If Winnipeg CFS closed her case, then there was the possibility that they had closed other cases as well. Understandably, there was a massive political fallout because of the case, with many calling for Christine Melnick to resign. Manitoba CFS is overseen by the Child Protection Branch, a provincial government department which Christine Melnick was responsible for. The former foster family of Phoenix were at the forefront. Frankie Edwards, who was Phoenix's foster sister, started a petition calling for her resignation. Kim said that this was only the beginning in their search for justice for Phoenix, adding that the family wanted people to be held accountable for what had happened, so that better laws are implemented to protect children. As a matter of fact, Phoenix wasn't the only child known to the Manitoba CFS that had been murdered in 2005. There were 9 children known to the Manitoba CFS that were murdered in 2005 alone, one of whom was also from the Fisher River Cree Nation. It would then be announced by the government that they were ordering two reviews, one of which would be examining the system as a whole, and be headed by the provincial ombudsman, the children's advocate, and a CFS director from Ontario. The second review would be headed by the provincial ombudsman, the children's advocate, and a psychologist. One review would focus on the opening and closing of cases of children that are in care, as well as how files are transferred, and the caseloads of the social workers on the front line. The other review would be focusing on looking at how cases are managed, as well as the administrative and financial areas of CFS. Then on the 21st of March, investigators announced that they had received information which they believed could lead them to Phoenix's body. Forensic investigators began to secure an area near the garage dump at the Fisher River Cree Nation, and the excavation was expected to be a tedious one. The ground had frozen, which made it much more difficult to dig. During a search, when the ground is frozen, a lot more care needs to be taken so as to not damage any potential evidence. They would use an industrial heater to thaw the ground before meticulously combing through the dirt with spoons and sifters. Days later, it would be announced that investigators had found evidence that Phoenix was buried where they had been digging. However, they said that they believed animals had carried off her remains. They refused to elaborate any further. Sergeant Steve Colwell said in a statement, "Right now, we have evidence to support that Phoenix was at this location." In early April, it would be revealed that the ground search had uncovered an empty grave. The search was called off due to the heavy snow, but investigators vowed that they would be renewing the search as soon as they could. Meanwhile, around 100 people gathered at the steps of the Manitoba Legislature for a candlelight vigil for Phoenix, as well as other children who had died in care. Her foster sister Frankie said, "I carry so many memories of her. She was a very beautiful girl." Kim said that she had found comfort in the large crowd that had gathered, saying that she had hoped it would spark change. The search for Phoenix's body was resumed in mid-April, and as the search was ongoing, an inmate in Headingley came up with the idea for inmates to raise money for a memorial for Phoenix. Carl Constant, who was serving time for assault and weapons offences, sewed a special star blanket to be draped over Phoenix's casket when her body was finally found. He said, "I did it because she's Native. She was innocent and she had to endure what she did. We just felt like we had to do a little bit." Another inmate drew a likeness of Phoenix on the blanket and said that the yellow that went around it represented Phoenix's aura as an angel, and the red represented the blood she spilled. Inmates at Headingley Prison raised $835, while inmates at Rockwood Institution raised $580. David Crate, chief of the Fisher River Cree Nation, said that the memorial would be placed in the community along a stretch of riverside, known as the Memorial Boardwalk. When Kim learned of the memorial, however, she wasn't happy that it was going to be placed in the Fisher River Cree Nation, stating, "Over my dead body is a plaque going up at Fisher River. What the inmates did was just beautiful, but Fisher River and David Crate denied Phoenix until they couldn't deny her anymore." As a kid, there was nothing better than grabbing a bowl of cereal. Growing up, however, you begin to realise that they're full of sugar and junk, and not really ideal for breakfast. Well, that's where Magic Spoon comes in. It has 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. There's also only 140 calories in each serving. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. There's a variety pack of 4 flavours, including cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. It's exactly like the amazing cereal you ate as a kid, but it's super healthy. So head on over to magicspoon.com/morbidology and grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code MORBIDOLOGY at checkout to save $5 on your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money with no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/morbidology Use the code Morbidology to save $5 off. Thank you to Magic Spoon for sponsoring this episode of Morbidology. When I need a break from true crime writing, my go-to is Best Fiends, the mobile puzzle game filled with cute characters. I'm sure you've already heard of the game. They have over 100 million downloads, and it really seems like everybody is playing it, and you should be too. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. As you progress through the game, you collect these cute little monsters that you can then evolve. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and it's fun to play, making it the perfect game for both adults and children. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it in the morning in bed, and when I'm out walking my dog. I'm already on level 281. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Finally, on the 22nd of April, Phoenix's remains were discovered in a wooded area near the garage dump in the Fisher River Cree Nation. Following the grim discovery, Phoenix's family finally publicly spoke about the case for the first time. Sheila Sinclair, the sister of Phoenix's birth father, Steve Sinclair, said that they cared for Phoenix, but had been misled into thinking that she was still alive, months after her death. She said that she had run into Samantha in February and asked where Phoenix was, because she hadn't seen her since the previous spring. She said that Samantha said that Phoenix was at home when she had been dead for more than 7 months. In July, the CFS reviews were completed, but some of the findings weren't released until the following month. Out of the 6,889 children that needed to be contacted for the review, all but 3 teenagers were located. The missing teenagers were then classified as runaways. This was the only information publicly released regarding the reviews with Christine Melnick, stating that the results of the reviews would be made available to those conducting the external and internal reviews. Meanwhile, Samantha was seeking bail, but a Court of Queen's Bench judge ruled that Samantha would remain in custody while awaiting trial. Just the following month, sweeping changes were made to Premier Gary Doer's cabinet, and these changes included Christine Melnick being removed from the Family Services Ministry. Shortly thereafter, the review of Manitoba's child welfare system was released, and it had concluded that a pattern of difficulties may have led to Phoenix's death, as well as other children's death, but the deaths couldn't be attributed to a complete breakdown of the system. In fact, the report revealed 145 deaths of children who were known to CFS since 1994, but the report claimed that the system was not to blame. The reports recommended improvements in CFS, ranging from how records are kept and shared to how children at risk are assessed. They also called on the government to reduce caseloads so that workers can visit children more often and improve training. When the findings of the report were publicised, a public inquiry was ordered to look at the circumstances surrounding Phoenix's death. Premier Gary Doer said that the inquiry would examine the shortcomings of family, community, child welfare and elected officials leading up to Phoenix's death. While the inquiry was a step in the right direction, Kim questioned how the government could call a public inquiry but fail to accept responsibility for the death of Phoenix, as well as the other children in care who had been killed. The Winnipeg Sun referred to the report findings as a whitewash and questioned how the child welfare system could be cleared of blame when their internal operations were plagued by so many problems. Just days later, it was announced that the child welfare system would be receiving a $42 million boost, which was to be used to fix issues that the report found. It was referred to as the legacy of Phoenix Sinclair. $5 million was provided immediately to improve the 24-hour response system. Another $11.5 million would be made available over the course of the next 3 years to hire 150 new social workers and to improve the system for tracking children. then $22 million would be going towards prevention and early intervention initiatives to help troubled families. Catherine Cook, the Director of Aboriginal Health from Winnipeg Regional Health Authority, and Reg Toews, founder of the former Children and Youth Secretariat, were given the duty of overseeing the implementation of the recommendations at all four of the child welfare authorities. In June the following year, Samantha and Carl were ordered to go directly to trial without having a preliminary hearing. Direct indictments such as this are typically done in cases where the safety of witnesses or urgency in getting the case to trial are pivotal issues. Phoenix's body was still lying in a mortuary because defence lawyers were wanting to get a second opinion on her cause of death. Kim and Phoenix's birth father had hired lawyers to try and speed up the release of her body. They wanted Phoenix to have a proper burial as well as a grave that they could visit. In December, the Phoenix Sinclair Foundation Incorporated was established. The purpose of the foundation was to help families work through similar situations and to prevent something similar happening to another child. The foundation was the work of Kim, who stated, "The ultimate goal of the foundation is to alleviate the grief in all ways. We'd like to start off by helping people financially, whether it be helping with headstones or funeral costs." She said that later on she'd like the foundation to widen its scope and be able to include referrals for grief counselling and legal assistance, as well as mentoring programs and support groups for young parents and art programs for children. She also hoped that the foundation would lobby for the well-being of children and act as a watchdog for care agencies. The foundation was funded by donations and had no government assistance. Samantha and Carl were ready to go to trial by November of 2008. Up until this moment, very little was publicly released regarding Phoenix's life and death. In fact, her cause of death hadn't even been publicly released. The trial would be the first time that the public would know what happened to Phoenix, and nobody was prepared to learn of the horrors that had been inflicted on her. During the opening statements, it was revealed that Phoenix had been abused for months before Samantha and Carl delivered fatal blows, leaving Phoenix to die alone on the cold basement floor. Instead of seeking out medical help, which was just 5 kilometres away, the couple instead wrapped Phoenix's body in a plastic bag and then buried her in a wooded area beside the garbage dump. You can see a photograph of the home where Phoenix had lived up on the Vodacast app. Prosecutor Rick Saul warned the jury that they would be hearing gruesome and enraging evidence over the course of the trial. He stated, "This little girl died as a result of months of abuse." He said that after Phoenix's death, nobody noticed that she was gone. Nobody ever reported her missing. Even after her death, Samantha and Carl applied for and received welfare payments listing Phoenix as a dependent. One of the first witnesses to testify was Stephanie Roulette, who was one of Carl's nieces. She revealed that Samantha and Carl had used her daughter to convince welfare investigators and investigators that Phoenix was still alive. Stephanie said that Samantha had asked for her daughter to pretend to be Phoenix. When she asked why, Samantha had told her that Phoenix was staying in Ontario with her father. She said to the jury, "I thought I was doing a favour for somebody." Welfare inspector Ed Mann testified that when he met Samantha with the little girl she claimed was Phoenix in March of 2006, he knew right away that it wasn't Phoenix. The little girl was only 3 years old, while Phoenix was 5 years old. The jury also heard from Loretta Stevenson, the former common law wife of Carl and the mother of 2 of his sons. She said that in June of 2005, her sons went to visit Carl in the Fisher River Cree Nation. She said that when they came home, one of her sons appeared to be extremely upset. She stated, "I knew there was something bothering him. He told me, my dad killed somebody." According to Loretta, she called a local child and family agency, but couldn't recollect if she called police. She further revealed that during her relationship with Carl, he had violently abused her. The court would then watch a taped interview between Samantha and investigators.
"You've done very well, Sam. You've done a good thing here, and I appreciate you being honest with me and telling the truth. You did the right thing. There's a couple things that we talked about that I'm a little bit confused on, though, because I feel like I kind of have two different stories about it, so I want to make sure I got it right and get the truth about what happened, okay?
In the tea, Samantha sat with her head hung low and her arms crossed on her chest. In a quiet tone, she told investigators that her lawyer had advised her not to speak. She was implored to do the right thing and responded by stating, "I didn't kill her. I didn't beat her to death. I didn't move the body."
But then we talked about what happened down there.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm confused, is the time when you talked about the puke, but then you also talked about Phoenix being thrown across the floor, or thrown onto the floor, banging her head.
Yeah, that was the day before.
Okay, so that's where I'm confused about, as what day, what thing happened. Mm-hmm. So...
Like, what do you mean? Like,
the day before she died. So we know she died on June 11th, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on June 10th, what happened that day? What happened to her that day? Those things you were telling me about?
That's the day I was pushed her. She banged her head on the floor.
Okay.
That's what I said. She banged her head on the floor.
Right.
Was pushed her.
See, I thought you said that that was the day that she died.
No.
Okay. So this is why I want to talk, to make sure I've got it right, because there was parts that confused me about that. So on June 10th, the day before, that's when he threw her and she hit her head on the floor. Okay, so what else happened that day? Now, you had told me about hitting her in the leg a couple times with that bar, that pipe. I think you called it a bar, maybe?
A pole.
Yeah. So did you hit her with that thing that day, the same day that he pushed her and she hit her head? Okay, so what day did you hit?
That was a different day. I don't know what day that was. That was a different day. I know that wasn't the day before she died.
She said that the last time she saw Phoenix, she was alive, and as she said, just laying there. She said that she was breathing when she left the house, but when asked how long she was gone, she didn't reply, stating, "I told my lawyer I wasn't going to say anything." Samantha would reveal to investigators that Phoenix would be put in a makeshift pen, which was just a cage in the basement when she misbehaved. She said that she would sometimes be left there all day, and she would be hit or choked when she cried. She said that Phoenix would also be shot with a pellet gun, which caused her to make what she described as little cries. When she vomited, Phoenix would be forced to eat her own vomit. Samantha claimed that the abuse was inflicted on Phoenix by Carl, not her. She said that the day before Phoenix had died, Carl had pushed her against the floor, causing her to hit her head. She further stated to investigators that when she found Phoenix's body, she was naked on the basement floor, and said that her anus appeared to be open, stating, "I said it looks like somebody put something up there." McKay said no. If somebody did that, then there would be blood. When investigators asked if Samantha thought that Phoenix had been raped, she said that she hoped not. According to Samantha, she had wanted to help Phoenix, but Carl wouldn't let her, adding, "She'd just start crying and he'd get all mad. Sometimes he would just beat her for nothing." Samantha said that after they buried Phoenix, Carl scrubbed the basement floor and then painted it. She said that she had threatened to go to police months later, but was too afraid. During a break when the investigators were out of the interrogation room, Samantha began to speak to herself. She said, "I'm so sorry, Phoenix. I didn't mean to. It wasn't planned, that's for sure. We didn't do it purposely. It was just something that got out of hand. An accident. But that doesn't cut it. I know you're never going to come back. You didn't mean to harm anybody. I told my lawyer I wasn't going to say anything. I can't keep this in forever. I had to tell the truth." She then stands up and walks around the interrogation room before stating, "We had a life. We had nice things until this happened. This didn't mean to happen. This wasn't supposed to happen. You had a whole life ahead of you, Phoenix, and it was all taken away from you. You don't deserve any of this. Nobody does. I love you. I do love you. After the taped interview was played out, Phoenix's stepbrother, Derek Stevenson, who was the son of Carl and Loretta, would take the witness stand. He told the jury that Phoenix was regularly shot with a pellet gun and was choked until she lost consciousness in a game that the family called Chicken. He said that Carl used to always shoot Phoenix with his younger brother's pellet gun and tell her to run. He said that his father enjoyed shooting Phoenix and that she would cry. He also said that he had seen Carl lift Phoenix up by the neck and choke her until she blacked out, before throwing her onto the tile floor, where she would twitch. According to Derek, he and his brother had visited the home in the Fisher River Cree Nation several times before Phoenix had died. He said that Phoenix used to be chubby, but by April of 2005, she was worryingly thin. He said that in the time they visited, he had never once seen Phoenix eat or use the bathroom. He said that he had tried to give her food in the past, but was threatened by Samantha. Derek's 15-year-old brother, who was the one who went to police, would testify next. He shook and covered his face as he spoke about how Samantha and Carl used to beat Phoenix, sometimes with their fists and other times with a metal rod. Reiterating what his brother said, he said that Phoenix was often shot with a pellet gun, just for the hell of it. He told the jury how Phoenix had been beaten and stomped on so much that she just stopped crying. He said that after one beating, Phoenix's knuckles were cut open and they became infected, but Samantha and Carl refused to seek help. Her knuckles had been cut with a metal broomstick, which she was being hit with when it snapped. On another occasion, he said that he witnessed both Carl and Samantha beating Phoenix, stating they would take turns punching her. He said that one night he heard Phoenix crying in the basement through the vents and went down to check on her. He said that the basement was absolutely freezing, and Phoenix was curled up in a ball without a blanket. He revealed that when Carl was beating or choking Phoenix, Samantha would laugh. Turning to the jury, he said, "I would look at their faces and I wouldn't see no tears or nothing, no remorse." He told the jury that on the day Phoenix had died, Carl had beat her and stomped on her head as well as her chest. He pushed her and then left her on the basement floor while Samantha watched. He said that when the couple left the house to visit Carl's father, he went down to the basement to check on Phoenix, and he thought that she was playing dead. When Samantha and Carl returned home to find Phoenix dead, they told the boy to stay at home to watch his baby sister and that they were going to the dump to bury Phoenix. Following the testimony of the two boys, the jury would then watch a videotaped confession between Carl and investigators, which took place in March of 2006.
Phoenix, she was in your life, right?
Yeah.
She was in your life. But because of whatever was going on in life, pressures, medication, whatever it may be, things got a little crazy, right? Did you mean to do that to her? Did you mean to go that far? Or was it one of those situations where a nice guy made a mistake? Wesley, did you mean to do that to Phoenix? Did you mean to do that purposely? Or was it just something that was beyond your control? Did you do that on purpose to her? Because if you did that on purpose, I can't understand. How come it happened? We know it happened. We know it happened. Why did it have to happen? You don't know? Do you regret what happened?
Yeah, I regret.
Do you?
Whatever I did in my old life, I regret it.
Yeah. If you could change one thing in your life, what would you change right now? Right now? Huh?
I know my lawyer advised me to say nothing.
I know. But you know what? All the lawyers do that. And that's right. That's your legal obligation. But you know what? You have values that are speaking out. You have values, right? There's things that you need to get off your chest. And I know. That's why I've sat here with you this long. I know. I could have walked out right away. But I know what you're about. I know you feel bad. I can see the tears, and that tells me a lot. I'm not judging you, okay? I'm not.
What am I just worried about my children?
I know you do. I know you do. And you know what? I know you do, and that tells me a lot. You should be concerned. If you weren't concerned with them, if you weren't concerned about them right now, I don't know what I would think about you. I know you're concerned. You had two kids, two beautiful kids, right?
In the interview, Carl said that when he found Phoenix's lifeless body, he attempted to perform CPR on her.
And then I tried to save her.
Yeah, what'd you do?
I tried to give her CPR.
Yeah. And what happened?
What did it come to?
No. That must have been hard, eh? That must have been hard.
I made a big mistake.
I know. But you know what?
I got to pay for it, so.
But you know what? You know what? You're owning up to it, right? Right? The good fellow that you are owning up to it. You realized you made a mistake. Right?
Yeah.
You did make a mistake. What was it that set you off that day? I mean, we all have pressures in our life. Okay? Was it medication? Was it stress? Was it people bothering you? Was it fear? What was it that set you off?
I don't know what the hell happened.
I'm sorry?
I don't know. I don't know. It's such a tragic thing.
It is a tragic thing, but you're taking a first step, right?
He denied that he ever choked or shot Phoenix and said that Phoenix was always crying and whining about something. He said to the investigators that on the day Phoenix had died, he told her to shut up and threw her around 3 or 2 feet onto the basement floor. He said that Phoenix landed on a pile of clothes and was still breathing when they left to visit his father. He claimed the day before Phoenix died, Samantha had hit her on the head, although he said he didn't witness it. Carl quickly turned on Samantha and said that she used to beat Phoenix up and that she had a lot of anger issues inside her, which she took out on her daughter. He said that Samantha would often say she wished she could get rid of Phoenix or give her back to her father, and stated, Samantha would just treat her like an animal, adding that she had no heart. During the videotape, Carl began to cry and said, I didn't want to kill the little kid. Once in a while, I would give her a licking. I didn't intend to do serious harm. He shared his fear with the investigator of spending the rest of his life in prison.
You can't change the facts, right? You're done.
I wish it was.
I know.
Wish it would never happen to
you. I know you do.
Pick it up once I don't find it. Kill anybody but life.
Nobody does, unless you're a serial killer. I know you're not. Serial killers go out and do that. It's the people that make mistakes. And you're the guy that made the mistake that day.
You know, I do feel a little better that I told you.
I know you do. It takes a load off your shoulders. I know.
Maybe now she can rest in peace.
That's a good thing you said. Maybe she can. I hope for your sake she can. When did this happen? You must have that day. That day must be embedded in your mind.
It's June 11th.
How do you remember June 11th?
That's the day we buried her.
Yeah? Did you write it down somewhere?
No, it's stuck in my head.
Yeah? June 11th, what year?
2005.
Okay. All right.
Towards the end of the interview, Carl said he wanted to apologize to Phoenix and said that what happened was going to haunt him for the rest of his life. The trial would also reveal that it was Carl who had directed investigators to Phoenix's body. Investigators had recorded him taking them to the area where she had been buried.
The date is March 17th, the year 2006. The time right now is 9:46 p.m. We're out at the Fisher River. We're just past the garbage dump road here. I'm just for the record, I'm Corporal Norm Shred of the Serious Crimes Unit of the RCMP, and Constable Bobby Baker, and operating the camera is Corporal Randy Hooker of the Winnipeg Forensic Ident Section. We are leaving the garbage dump road, and Carl Wesley McKay is going to take us to where Phoenix Sinclair is buried.
minutes and years.
Okay.
So at that point, we're standing there.
Where the light is?
Right about here.
Okay. Okay, so you've marked this spot here.
Yeah.
Oh, so and can you mark where else it's going to be?
Okay.
Now, is that the other spot?
This might be the spot, yeah.
Okay. So.
Yeah, because that looks a little deeper in.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure I was about here.
Yeah? How far off the trail?
It wasn't very far off the trail here.
Yeah.
Because there's another trail right here.
Okay.
And we're, I think it was this spot here.
Okay.
Right in here.
All right. So it's either going to be there or there. Which spot is it going to be?
I think most likely here.
Most likely?
Yeah. Because I'm pretty sure I didn't go into it.
Like if we're talking percent, how sure are you?
About 99.9%.
Yeah?
Because this is too deep in.
Okay. And where in there is Phoenix Sinclair?
Right this way.
Okay.
And exactly where in there?
Okay. How far in the ground? How far in the ground will she be?
Approximately about 8 inches.
About 8 inches?
8 to 10 inches.
Okay. And what'd you use, by the way?
I use a spade.
All right. And did anybody help you burying Phoenix Sinclair?
Myself and Samantha.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to say while we're here? This is your time.
Yeah. I've done this for Phoenix to recover her body.
Okay.
Because she deserves a proper burial. And I've done it for my boys as well as myself and Samantha.
All right. Okay. Anything else you want to say, Wes?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Cause you guys, because I know it's your job, and you shouldn't be out here, and Phoenix should be out roaming.
Well, we'll get her out.
Yes.
Okay. I think that's about it. How will we find her in there? How will she be?
She'll be face up. The plastic is. I wrap her in plastic with a yellow rain jacket, her head being covered with the head part, and the rest of her body will be like.
Okay.
If you would like to watch the entire video of Carl directing investigators to Phoenix's body, then you can watch it on the Vodacast app. According to Carl, the fact that he told investigators where Phoenix was buried was evidence that he had a heart. He had initially given investigators a hand-drawn map showing where Phoenix had been buried, but the map wasn't detailed enough, so Carl accompanied investigators to the burial site. He was driven from Headingley Jail to the area beside the rubbish dump, where he and Samantha had buried Phoenix. On the way, he stated, "I'm sorry, you shouldn't be out here. Phoenix shouldn't be out here." He said to the investigators that he had done a very sad thing, by burying Phoenix beside a rubbish dump. Carl and four investigators had made their way to the remote wooded location on snowmobiles, and then they trudged through the thick snow before coming to an opening. The area was illuminated by lights, as Carl explained. It wasn't very far off the trail. I think it was just this spot here. He said he was 99% sure that they had the right spot and that he and Samantha had used a shovel to dig a hole. He told the investigators that they had poured pepper into the grave before covering it to throw police dogs off the scent. He said that he had gotten the idea from the TV show Crime Scene Investigation. Following the videotape, Sergeant Randy Hooker of the Forensic Identification Unit testified. He described how they carefully sealed off the scene and brought in industrial heaters to melt the snow. A large tent was erected over the site, and then the dig for Phoenix began. He described to the jury how signs of Phoenix began to emerge just 8 centimetres beneath the surface. They found pieces of the yellow raincoat that she had been buried in, as well as pieces of a black garbage bag, a yellow rope, and a brass button. Then they found a bone. Sergeant Hooker said that the bone was protruding out of the ground. They then found 4 other bones that were completely intact. They then expanded their search and found a skull that was identified as Phoenix's. Deborah Merritt, a biological anthropologist, would take the jury through Phoenix's injuries. She had spent 3 months examining Phoenix's remains and told the jury that each part of her body was affected by injuries. She showed the jury an illustration of her skeleton, which was dotted with red, signifying points where Phoenix had suffered bone injuries and new bone had grown. An illustration of Phoenix's skull was covered in red dots, while a photograph of her skull showed a large unhealed fracture, which had been inflicted around 2 months before her death. Other injuries included a fractured nasal bone, which had been inflicted around 8 weeks before her death, a fractured collarbone, 2 injuries to her shoulder blade inflicted at separate occasions, several fractured ribs, some of which had been fractured more than once, as well as numerous injuries to her legs and pelvis. Pathologist Charles Littman would testify that Phoenix had suffered so many serious injuries that it was impossible to pinpoint what exactly had caused her death. He said that her cause of death couldn't be more specific than multiple non-accidental trauma, adding that the only way she could have sustained such injuries accidentally were if she were involved in a car accident. He told the jury that Phoenix was most likely in constant pain due to her plethora of injuries. He said, "Every breath, every cough would cause pain, considerable pain." He said that the repeated abuse very likely resulted in Phoenix developing a high pain threshold, which made her able to walk without a constant limp. He also said that Phoenix's malnutrition would have worsened the impact of her injuries. Barbara Leesk, who was Carl's niece, next told the jury that shortly after Phoenix's death, she'd been at the couple's home and they were watching cold case files on A&E. Samantha asked her what she would do if she had to get rid of a body, before Carl chimed in, saying that he would wrap the body in garbage bags, cover it with spices and pepper, and then take it to the bush, dig a hole, and bury it. It was exactly the same thing he had done to Phoenix. She said to the courtroom, "He said no one would ever find it. I didn't think anything. I thought we were just talking about the show." Other family members would also testify. They all said that they were told that Phoenix was alive and well and was just living with her father in Ontario. One of the most emotional moments of the trial came when Kim took to the witness stand to testify. She said that for the first 3 years of Phoenix's life, Samantha was essentially a stranger to her. She said that she only visited her daughter around 4 or 5 times over those 3 years and showed very little physical affection towards her. She said that during one visit, Samantha had called Phoenix a bitchy baby when she refused to sit on her lap. She described Phoenix as a curious and fun-loving little girl who enjoyed laughing and playing and loved life. Kim had been the only constant thing in Phoenix's life, and she showed her love and affection, treating her like she was her own biological child. In a way, her testimony, albeit heartbreaking, was comforting because it showed that Phoenix did experience love during her short and tragic life. During the closing arguments, Prosecutor Saul said that it was inevitable that Phoenix's life would come to such a grim ending. She had been abused by both Samantha and Carl in the months leading up to her death. He said that neither of the accused cared whether Phoenix lived or died. He said that it didn't matter who the ringleader was, that both Samantha and Carl had participated in the abuse and murder of Phoenix. During the defense's closing arguments, they once again turned on the other defendant and placed the blame solely on them. Samantha's defense team said that she was a bad mother to a dead daughter, but she wasn't a murderer. Defense lawyer Sarah Innes suggested that Samantha was guilty of manslaughter for not preventing her daughter's murder, and asserted that it was Carl who dealt the fatal blows that killed Phoenix. She said, "No one could say what happened to Phoenix is anything but horrific and cruel. She treated her daughter terribly, but she didn't kill her." Kimach was dominated and intimidated by McKay, a man 20 years her senior. He ruled that house with an iron fist. Carl's defense team countered this by saying that it was Samantha who dominated Carl, and Samantha who inflicted the worst abuse on Phoenix. The jury were then sent away to deliberate. After 2 days, they were still deliberating. They were evidently struggling to reach a verdict and forwarded a question to Justice Karen Simonson. They asked whether the commission of an unlawful act and an act of omissions are both required to prove a murderous state of mind. She responded by telling the jury that they could establish state of mind through either avenue. Then the following day, the jury returned with a verdict. They found both Carl and Samantha guilty of first-degree murder. They received an automatic sentence of life in prison, allowed the possibility of parole for 25 years. Both Samantha and Carl were allowed to make a statement. Samantha said that she loved Phoenix, while Carl said that he was sorry. Following the sentencing, loved ones of Phoenix were allowed to provide impact statements. Phoenix's birth father, Steve, said that Phoenix never knew what pain was when she was with him, and knowing what his daughter endured teared him up. He said that he still hadn't been able to bury his daughter, and said he hoped to believe the time heals all things. Kim said that Phoenix was a gift to her from the heavens, and that she had a smile that would light up the room. In April of 2009, Phoenix was finally laid to rest. On what would have been her ninth birthday, friends and family gathered at the Indian and Metis Friendship Center on Robinson Street to pay their final respects. Her small white casket sat at the front of the room, surrounded by stuffed animals and wreaths made from flowers. On the top of her casket, her father placed a single rose. Speaking of Phoenix, he said, "She was just a person like everyone else. She loved to swim and have gum. She was a typical kid. I remember her smile, her laugh, everything." Afterwards, Phoenix was buried at Brookside Cemetery. From behind bars, Samantha would grant an interview with Winnipeg Free Press.
Like, why did you print that? Like, the first thing was she killed her kid, like... Right. That was the first line of the article, and I just, like, got, I don't know, like, angry about it, because there is no, she killed her kid.
Of course, the jury has found that you killed your kid. They didn't find you not guilty of murder. I mean, you're right, they found you, their finding is that you both killed Phoenix.
See, but that's the thing, like, there is no they, us, or we in this about killing her, like how people are saying, or how he's saying too. And, like, I just, like what I said in court yesterday about people not hearing the truth. What really happened, like, that's what I mean, like, nobody's hearing the truth.
So what is the truth?
The truth is, I never killed her, it wasn't me, like, I wouldn't do something like that to my own child.
But there was evidence that...
The only evidence, like, that there is what people are saying. My truth is that I never did it. That's the thing. Nobody's understanding, like, getting it, that my truth was sitting right beside me in court all this time. He knows the truth that I didn't do this.
While the trial and verdict closed one chapter in the case, Phoenix's death was still to be the subject of a public inquiry, which would delve into the flawed child protection system in Manitoba. The guilty verdict was only a small step towards justice for Phoenix. The inquiry finally began in September of 2012, and it publicly revealed all of the past interaction Phoenix and her family had with CFS that I mentioned at the beginning of this episode. The inquest found that Phoenix's child protection file was closed a number of times without adequate intervention, and found that social workers had failed to monitor Phoenix for months at a time, despite the fact they knew she had come from a troubled family. A number of social workers admitted that they could have done more to protect Phoenix, but feared being too aggressive could backfire. Inquiry also revealed that supervision notes from CFS had gone missing, and that CFS had never conducted a background check on Carl. If they had have done, they would have found that he had allegations of domestic abuse, criminal convictions, alcohol problems, and prior involvement with CFS. In the final report into Phoenix's death, Commissioner Ted Hughes would make over 60 recommendations for improving the child welfare system, including assessing the well-being of a child when a family comes to their attention, and social workers not taking on more than 20 cases, He also recommended that Manitoba take the lead to address disproportionate number of Aboriginal children in care all throughout Canada. He wrote, at least 13 times throughout her life, Winnipeg Child and Family Services received notice of concerns for Phoenix's safety and well-being from various sources, the last one coming 3 months before her death. Ted Hughes wrote in his three-volume report, throughout, files were opened and closed, often without a social worker ever laying eyes on Phoenix. Unfortunately, the system failed to act on what it knew, with tragic results.
I, the woman who raised her, wanted to get justice for her, and I think that we've accomplished that in regards to the commissioner's recommendations. As I said, as far as the implementing of changes, I can't really comment as to whether it'll happen, because I've read the reports and they all read the same. There's going to be more Phoenixes, or there may be more Phoenixes. I know that there has been more Phoenixes since 2006.
The murder of Phoenix Sinclair was more than troubling on so many levels. How could a parent do this to their own child? And how could a little girl so easily fall off the radar screen of the very system that was put in place to protect her? In life, she suffered unimaginable abuse, and in death, she came to symbolise the feelings of a very broken system. Phoenix's legacy is that her tragic death led to sweeping changes in Manitoba's child and family services, and those changes will save numerous other children, just like Phoenix. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporter, Alexis. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return for your support, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms. You can also request a case for me to cover on Morbidology Plus. You also get merch, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes and much more. For those who didn't know, I'm going to be at CrimeCon in London in September of this year, and I'd love to see some of you guys there. The tickets are COVID-proof, meaning that if we can't go, they will be refunded or transferred to another date. Listeners of Morbidology get 10% off the tickets at crimecon.co.uk with promo code MORBID. Could I also ask you a massive favour and ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like, and I really love reading them. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, It's Murder Up North. Till next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hi, I'm Jenny, the host of It's Murder Up North. If you're curious about the murderous north of England, this podcast is definitely for you. I've lived in various parts of the north of England. I went to college in the shadow of Saddleworth Moor, where Myra Hindley and Ian Brady buried those 5 innocent children. I've worked in the city of Leeds, where the Yorkshire Ripper targeted his victims in the 1970s. Knowing how geographically close I have been to these crimes made me curious, and that curiosity became this podcast. However, my main hope is to help you see the person, not the victim.